Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help you God?
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, we are going to talk through the upcoming Senate impeachment trial. Big news. We're going to do the play-by-play, as far as we know it, from the swearing-in of the senators and the Chief Justice all the way through the closing arguments. And we have some idea of how things will proceed, thanks to our guest's reporting on the preparations and his encyclopedic knowledge of what happened in the Clinton impeachment. But first, we're going to talk to some of our numbers nerds about polling and the upcoming Iowa caucuses for Democrats, what the most recent 2020 numbers tell us, and also how that plays into a recent spate of congressional endorsements we've seen for the top candidates heading into Iowa. As always, a quick note that we are taping this on Thursday, January 16th. So anything breaking that happens after that, we will talk about it on a future episode. All right, let's dive right in. We've got Steve Shepard, one of our campaign editors, a polling expert. He's here in the studio. Steve, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Allie Mutnick, who covers House candidates and elections for Politico. Allie, welcome back to the Nerdcast.
Thank you.
So, Steve, we just suffered through a bit of a polling drought over the holidays. It was a little unclear exactly what was going on in the Democratic presidential race, but we've since been hit by a wave of new surveys on the 2020 race in the past week, with Iowa, New Hampshire, and other early voting states drawing closer. So, Steve, what is the picture painted by these new polls?
Yes, and no one suffered more than I through that drought. The picture is muddled, especially at the top. These polls and the ones we're going to talk about were conducted prior to Tuesday's debate in Iowa, which, of course, the candidates are hoping for big bounces out of. So I just want to lay down that caveat. What it showed is essentially a four-car pileup right at the top of the race. Both polls from the Des Moines Register and CNN and also from Monmouth University showed Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren all pretty tightly bunched together in some different orders. Joe Biden was fourth among that group in one poll and first in the other. So, you know, there's some variability there. But in essence, especially when you deal with the margins of error and how far we are still out from the caucuses, when these polls were conducted, it was more than 3 weeks. These candidates are essentially tied.
Everyone kind of hanging around between like 16 and 21%, it seems like, in the if you average everything together. In one sense, you know, a close race heading into Iowa, that's almost par for the course. Iowa, it seems like occasionally, but very rarely, does blowouts in these caucuses. It seems like there's always something close brewing. But the fact that there's four candidates bunched so closely is kind of remarkable.
It is. We haven't seen that. It's been a while since we've seen that on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, we did kind of see that. We saw that in 2016 with the large field. We saw that certainly in 2012 when Rick Santorum notched a very narrow victory out of Iowa. But on the Democratic side, it's been a little bit more clear cut. You know, in 2016, it was very, very, very close between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, but they were really the only two candidates. Martin O'Malley was barely viable anywhere. In 2008, there was three candidates. It was Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and John Edwards. And there wasn't really a fourth viable candidate. You really kind of have to go down to 2004 to find a race where the top tier is this kind of crowded and bunched together. And we did end up seeing some separation that year.
Yeah, of course. That's what I was about to say. In 2004, we saw big movement very late.
Yes. Yes. And propelling John Kerry to victory, we saw Dick Gephardt, who had been viewed as a top, you know, favored candidate at one point in Iowa from neighboring Missouri. He ended up finishing fourth in that caucus. So my message that I'm getting from both the polls and from talking to folks on the ground is anything really can happen here. And it would take a lot to surprise me in terms of the range where these candidates could end up finishing. It wouldn't, while there's this four-car pileup right now, it wouldn't surprise me if on Monday, February 3rd, we're talking about something that's a little bit more stratified and a little bit more clear-cut and where there's a little bit more separation between the candidates.
Despite that muddled picture, what can we tell about what's going on? What kind of movement has there been in the last month or so? Is the story particularly different in Iowa or New Hampshire?
some of the movement is pretty consistent. Of course, Iowa, New Hampshire, the polls there differ from what they do nationally, where Joe Biden is the leader and Bernie Sanders is a pretty clear second place, with Elizabeth Warren close behind and Pete Buttigieg farther behind and fourth. That's not the case in Iowa, New Hampshire, where they're all tightly bunched together, though we have you teased at it. We have seen some movement. Pete Buttigieg had in the fall surged to first place in Iowa in a lot of the polls that we'd seen. He has fallen back some. Elizabeth Warren had her surge a few months before that. She has come back to the pack. But notably, they've only come back to the pack. They haven't fallen through. They haven't fallen. Their candidacies are still very much alive to come out with one of the top three tickets in Iowa moving into New Hampshire. So while we've seen these candidates kind of surge and decline, we haven't seen any candidates kind of fall off.
And of course, you know, Bernie Sanders right there in the thick of this race for first place, which actually in a second is going to bring us to our other topic of conversation this segment. But Steve, I want to circle back and suggest this bunching and this movement and everyone basically just kind of like getting pulled together around the 20% line basically suggests a really wild and interesting Iowa caucus night to come on February 3rd. And not only because we don't have a clear sense of who's winning right now or who's going to be winning in 3 weeks, but because of the nature of the caucuses and the way voters' second choices might come into play.
The Iowa caucuses are really interesting, Scott, in the way they're conducted. It's not a traditional vote where people go into a voting booth. They show up on caucus night and there's a first round of voting. And in that first round, if your candidates are not at 15%, you can then join one of the other candidates at 15%. Now, you mentioned these candidates are tightly bunched around 15 or 20%. So they're all likely to be viable in most of the caucus sites unless things change pretty radically over the next couple of weeks. That means all the candidates who are below that level, if they don't reach 15% in a particular caucus site in that initial vote, their supporters are up for grabs in the second and final allocation. So you want to be, as a candidate, someone who appeals to supporters of people like Amy Klobuchar or Andrew Yang or Tom Steyer, and then of the candidates who've dropped out now, people like Cory Booker, Kamala Harris. You want to be a consensus candidate to bring those people over in that second allocation. That's really important. And so it's interesting to look at some of the polls and see who are the top second choices as well.
And Elizabeth Warren won one of the campaigns that has kind of been most explicit about trying to be everyone's second choice. And yet it's no sure thing just because of the vagaries of this process. There was one poll, right, where she was seen as the second choice of by far, I think, the most respondents in the poll. But also most of those people were supporting one of the other top candidates anyways. So when they kind of reallocated things, looking just at the top four candidates, she barely gained anything. So I thought that was a really good illustration of just how unpredictable things are going to be.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
When Iowa comes around.
In both of the polls that we saw come out over the past week, she was the top second choice in both polls of all the respondents. But that's what you mentioned. If you're the second choice of people who like Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg, that's not necessarily a great place to be, because if their supporters, if there are enough of them in a caucus site to be viable, 15%, those people can't move to another candidate.
Right. That second choice question never ends up being part of it.
It's only the people who are either undeclared when they show up and are looking to be convinced and maybe you're on the fence between two candidates and are waiting for that second round of voting to establish themselves with a particular campaign. Or it's people who support candidates who don't reach that threshold. So for Elizabeth Warren and for all of these top candidates, it behooves them to kind of reach out not to supporters of the other top candidates, but to supporters of the lower candidates and undecided voters as we close out the final couple of weeks of campaigning here.
So, Allie, I want to bring you in. All this polling talk and kind of establishing the really close nature of the race in Iowa – the first state to go, kind of sets the table for a story you were working on last week, which is that it seems like more and more in the midst of all this very close polling, we've seen some new movement from moderate House Democrats, especially freshmen, who had been staying neutral in the race, who had been staying on the sidelines, coming off the sidelines and looking to endorse some of the moderate candidates running for president, particularly former Vice President Joe Biden.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a story I did with Sarah Ferris and the Congress team, and we're kind of getting at this anxiety that some of these freshman members have that now it is 2020. This is an election year. And these are people who've never run in a presidential year. And so they're going to have something at the top of the ticket that they can't necessarily control. And I think there is a fear that a lot of them ran as moderates. They're in a centrist candidates. And so can they still do that with a Sanders or a Warren at the top of the ticket? And they're having conversations about that.
And so as you were writing the story last week, Biden had just gotten, I think, three battleground freshmen to endorse him. And then since then, we've seen another three Democrats from battleground districts endorse Biden. We've seen a Democrat in a Trump district in Staten Island, Max Rose, endorse Mike Bloomberg. It seems like there's a lot of other conversations going on with Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar sounding out some of these people.
Yeah, that's right. So something we found while we were reporting this story is that Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, Joe Biden have actually had these like little conference calls with the swing seat Democrats. And they've kind of made a pitch on, you know, why are they most electable? What are you guys seeing in your district? And our kind of readout from the Biden call was that a lot of people had been sharing polling. These swing seat freshmen have done polling in their districts testing, you know, a Biden head-to-head against Trump, maybe a Warren head-to-head against Trump, and that Biden had, you know, in some cases, unsurprisingly, performed much better. And this was a data point that made them feel comfortable and may lead to some more people coming out for Biden or explain their thinking.
Well, what kind of districts are we talking about here? Are these swing districts in swing states, you know, suburban, urban, rural? What's kind of the mix of places we're talking about?
I think you get both. So Joe Biden had an endorsement early in the month from Abby Finkenauer, and she's in a very kind of Obama, Trump, more working class rural Iowa district. But then you also have endorsements he's getting from people in these kind of like Romney Clinton districts that were, you know, affluent.
Like Colin Allred in Texas.
Like Colin Allred, exactly. And they think that he appeals to both of those candidates, and that's maybe what makes him such a strong top of the ticket.
Well, now here's a question for you. How much of the, and actually let's leave Abby Finkenauer aside because I feel like Iowa as a whole getting an endorsement from an Iowa member of Congress is a whole separate thing. But how much of this is are these members thinking about? It's like, I want to help push Joe Biden over the top. I'm going to do my part. And how much of it is them, do you think, looking out for number one and trying to think it's like this is what I need at the top of the ticket, or at least this is the preference that I feel like I need to show before my race starts in order to do the best for my chance of reelection.
I think right now they're really trying to inoculate themselves, right? So if like a Bernie Sanders or a Warren secures the nomination, they get to say, well, you know, not my first choice. I prefer to Joe Biden or I prefer to Pete Buttigieg. And then that gives them some kind of moderate credential among voters. I think maybe if we see like a Bernie or a Warren start to really gain steam when Iowa, as we move on to New Hampshire, maybe you will see them start to rush out to kind of boost a Biden, if that threat becomes more real.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the situation, we've seen it play out in a little bit different context a number of times. But I feel like that's just the sort of thing that Bernie Sanders eats for breakfast, right? The idea that and Warren, too, to some extent, the idea that the establishment is coming for him. And, you know, let me just dash off a quick email to my millions of followers saying, hey, can you chip in a couple bucks to help us deal with this dastardly establishment coming for us?
Yeah, I don't. We were told that Bernie and Warren were not asking for calls with these kind of frontliner Dems, or that they had not, you know, connected with them. So I don't know that these are endorsements they're looking for, and maybe this is a fundraising point for them.
That's interesting. Bernie Sanders obviously doesn't, but I feel like Warren kind of played a lot of that game. She raised a lot of money and campaigned for a lot of folks in the midterms in 2018.
Maybe it's in the works and it just hasn't happened yet. But I do know that some of them did have the polling, specifically Warren and Trump in their districts, and that it wasn't necessarily better than Biden, or they felt more comfortable with Biden's numbers.
That's interesting. Yeah, Steve, I mean, I'm curious what you think. I feel like, you know, endorsements are doing less than ever in terms of actually moving votes, but that doesn't mean they don't send interesting signals.
Yeah, no, certainly everything that these members do, both political and in terms of their official duties, should be viewed through political lens, because these are the majority makers for Democrats. These are the people who are truly, their seats are truly in play in 2020. And so they're going to do everything they can do to protect them. And specifically, if they're going to meddle in the presidential race and get involved, it is both, I think, to help the candidate they see is best for them, but also to send a signal to their voters back home about the kind of candidate they want them to be looking at when they go to the ballot next November and are staring at both the top of the ticket and that House race there. And they see the name of a Colin Allred in a place where Mitt Romney won and then Hillary Clinton won. And they expected a certain kind of Democrat. And so regardless of the name at the top of the ticket, these people want to make sure their images and their brands are intact.
This is really interesting. I like this conversation. We're looking at the views of the voters as reflected in the polls. We've got the party elites as reflected in Congress, bringing a lot of nice things together here. Thank you both for taking the time to join us. Thanks, Steve.
Anytime.
And thank you, Allie.
Of course.
And for our second segment this week, we are going to dive into the wild world of impeachment trials. And we have with us here today one of our expert tour guides who's going to help us decode all of this over the next few weeks, Politico senior reporter Darren Samuelson. Darren, thank you for returning to the Nerdcast.
Thanks for bringing me back.
All right. So here's what we want to do today, Darren. We're in, obviously, it's not uncharted territory, but it's lightly charted. We're in kind of a 15th century European explorer situation here. And so what we want to do today is I'm hoping you can basically just take us kind of chronologically through what is going to be going on the next few weeks. And we can start yesterday, actually. We can start on Wednesday when House Speaker Nancy Pelosi named her team of impeachment managers.
So today I'm very proud to present the managers.
That was kind of the step we've all been waiting for over the past few weeks since that vote with this big delay.
Yeah, they are the prosecutors. They will be the people who will present the case before the Senate and try and convict and remove Donald Trump from office. And they will be working from material that they collected over the course of that impeachment investigation that everyone paid so much attention to last fall and then ultimately into that House vote. We have seven impeachment managers that Nancy Pelosi has named.
Chair Adam Schiff of California, a lead manager.
Led by Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and Jerry Nadler.
Chairman Jerry Nadler, chair of the House Judiciary Committee.
The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. These two gentlemen know quite a bit about this case and can probably recite anything that they need to, you know, at the, you know, just off the top of their head. They will be the leaders. They're the ones you're going to be hearing talking the most. There are overall seven impeachment managers on the Pelosi team, which is a smaller number than the 13 that Bill Clinton's Republican nemesis, the charge that they led back during the 1999 impeachment trial. A lot of people thought back during that Clinton impeachment trial that there were too many House impeachment managers, that some of them were just not very good at their job and didn't really do a compelling case. They were kind of boring. People were clicking off the television while they were watching it, and that it was better to be more honed. And so I think with Pelosi picking the seven that she has, we're going to be hearing obviously from Schiff and Nadler, but we're also going to be hearing from Zoe Lofgren, who is a fascinating story. She was a congressional staffer back in the 1972-73-74 investigation of Watergate for a congressman from California whose seat that she later took over, who was on the Judiciary Committee, and she served on the Judiciary Committee during the Clinton impeachment, and now here she is on the Trump impeachment. So, you know, someone who actually has that incredible line that goes through the three impeachments of our modern era. You know, there's only four impeachments, three only involving presidents that went all the way to the Senate trial. We're going to see Val Demings, who is a former sheriff from Orlando, Florida, Hakeem Jeffries, who's a member of the House leadership, Sylvia Garcia and Jason Crow are two of the members who I think we'll be hearing less from.
Freshmen, right?
Yes.
All right. So they're the ones who are going to be presenting the case. Now, the trial officially begins Thursday the 16th. That's today. They're going to swear in Chief Justice John Roberts to preside over everything. But no arguments yet. They're going to be swearing in the senators and so on. And then after that, it looks like the first thing that we're going to expect is words that will set hearts aflutter everywhere when they hear this. Trial briefs.
Oh boy, I can hardly wait. Probably 100+ pages of material from the Trump lawyers, which will lay out their defense. It'll be the first time we're going to see anything from the Trump lawyers on paper presenting, you know, their rebuttal. It'll be very interesting to see if they go fact by fact and try and actually debunk this, or is it just, you know, in giant 143 font saying, you know, fake news, you know, giant hoax. But I think it's going to be the former. They're going to pick things apart.
That is interesting. Then we're going to see, because we've seen the giant 143 font response from Trump on Twitter every day for the last few months, and this is going to be potentially more interesting.
They have a Clinton model to go on. There's actually a Bill Clinton trial brief that was submitted in that impeachment case that the White House counsel's office and combined with the president's personal counsel, David Kendall, they put together this brief that took apart the Monica Lewinsky perjury charges. And so this document is something they've been working on for a while now. They will submit that, I think, either over the weekend or into Monday. Then the House Democrats will submit their version, which will probably look a lot like the impeachment report that the Judiciary Committee produced after the House vote, or maybe it was right before the House vote. You'll have these two, you know, legal documents that will give us sort of an outline of things. And, you know, it's notable as well for the Trump legal team. Remember, they sat out that entire House process. They refused to participate. Pat Cipollone wrote some 143 font, you know, responses and letters to Jerry Nadler and to Adam Schiff saying, you know, go take a hike. We're not going to participate because this process is not favorable to us. I think they feel, well, you know, they're putting their words now down on paper, and it'll be very interesting to see what they have to say.
That is very interesting. And so, like you said, you know, this process is expected to take about 4 to 6 days, which means people are going to be working through around the clock probably through the holiday weekend so that the main event can start on Tuesday. And that's the arguments.
Yeah. So, you know, this will be the last weekend for senators for a couple of weeks to go back home to rest up, because right after the Martin Luther King holiday on Tuesday, we'll rock and roll. And I think, you know, those briefs probably have been written already. They're probably putting the finishing touches on them. We get going on Tuesday, and I'm sure there's going to be some pomp and circumstance. This is the Senate. You know, I don't think it actually will start until probably the afternoon. If the Clinton trial is an example, I think it was noon or 1 p.m. that they get started every day. So, you know, we're going to have our mornings to nice leisurely read Political Playbook and, you know, just chill out. And then, boom, things are going to get going. It'll be interesting to watch John Roberts on the presiding officer. One of his biggest responsibilities is the clock and clock management. William Rehnquist was renowned for, as the presider in the Bill Clinton trial, letting things go later than senators maybe wanted it to go. He kept them around till 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and so it'll be interesting to see if the Senate on that same, you know, Roberts, who we should also add was a former clerk for Mr. Rehnquist, and so there is this continuity between Rehnquist and Roberts. And just going back an even further drop, Mr. Rehnquist wrote a book 3 or 4 years before he presided over the Bill Clinton trial about the Andrew Johnson impeachment trial. So Mr. Rehnquist was a student of history. And I think that Roberts will know all of that history as he oversees this trial. And so, yeah, we get going, you know, whether it's Tuesday or Wednesday, that's when the House managers will have their time to go. And I think we're still waiting to see exactly how much time they get. It was 3 days of a prosecution in the Clinton trial. And again, this goes back to they had 13 managers. And so 13 people got to speak. And that took a little bit of time. And,
right.
they picked things through one by one by one. And like you had the chairman, Henry Hyde of the Judiciary Committee, actually gave the opening overview. So if that's the model, Adam Schiff would do the same thing. He would be the sort of overview. And then they would maybe use each individual member to kind of go point by point on different aspects of it. Again, during the Clinton trial, you had, you know, Lindsey Graham was doing the impeachment precedents. Steve Chabot was doing perjury law. Bob Barr was doing perjury and obstruction. And it was just this methodical part where the senators are, you know, basically supposed to sit in their seats and listen as the prosecution does their spiel.
And yeah, it should be a big change for a lot of the senators. And then, of course, Trump's defense lawyers, and we're going to get that roster finalized sometime very soon. But, you know, expected to be White House counsel Pat Cipollone.
That is correct. Yeah. Politico readers from a couple days ago would know who the Trump legal team is expected to be. We've reported it for a while now. Mr. Cipollone, I think is actually the proper pronunciation.
We'll all find out very soon.
We will indeed. He came on about a year and a half ago, the end of 2018, to take over as the White House counsel, replacing Don McGahn, who had all kinds of controversy following him. But Cipollone will be the lead presenter. And if, again, the Clinton model is the best one, back in the Clinton trial, the White House counsel, Chuck Ruff, did give the opening statement, laid out the case. It was a long, detailed analysis of why Bill Clinton was not guilty. And I think if Cipollone follows that model, he'll go, you know, again, he'll be sitting there on the floor at the defense table while the House managers are presenting their case. So he'll be looking straight across at Adam Schiff, who his boss has been, you know, calling all kinds of names for the last many months now. And he'll have his two deputies, Pat Philbin and Michael Papura, who are associate counsels in the White House. They are George W. Bush administration veterans. Mr. Papura and Mr. Philbin have been part of the White House counsel's office since the start of the House Democratic leadership takeover in January of 2019. They were the ones responding to all of those oversight requests, telling the Democrats, you know, no. They were the ones who were sitting in on Hope Hicks's deposition before the Judiciary Committee, objecting to every single question that was being asked. And they've been the ones preparing, you know, kind of doing the legwork for Cipollone for the White House. And then Jay Sekulow.
You know, let me please finish the sentence.
Go ahead.
I think that
Everyone knows is sort of the president's quote unquote TV lawyer, the other TV lawyer besides Rudy Giuliani will be there as well. The rationale for that originally the thought was that Sekulow was not going to be a part of this process because this was sort of official acts at the White House mm-hmm. of President Trump in his official acts. But because the Democrats have made this about the Mueller investigation to some degree too and the 2016 election interference as sort of a larger pattern of behavior, they kind of opened the door for Sekulow to now step onto the floor too and provide a sweeping defense of Trump. That he'll give, and that could take 2 days, 3 days. They say it'll take. They're trying to move this thing faster along, and so maybe they'll only take a day instead of the three that Bill Clinton did.
Mm. So at this point in the trial, I think we get to the point where so far what we talked about, things are going to be pretty scripted. At this point, once the two sides are kind of finished presenting their arguments, that's when things could get a little more spontaneous. And then at that point, you know, you mentioned, Darren, that senators are not allowed to speak during the proceedings, but we could have a period of questioning after each team presents its case. Senators will have an opportunity to question the lawyers by submitting their questions through the Chief Justice.
Yeah, they'll put things down on writing, hand them to a page. There'll be a number of pages sitting around them who will bring them up and the Chief Justice would would read the questions aloud and let the prosecutors or the defense team respond. And I should say, while senators are not supposed to talk, they can stand up and raise objections. They can raise procedural points of order. They can and there was a famous one early on in the Clinton example where Tom Harkin, Iowa Democrat, stands up and he actually takes issue with something that Bob Barr, a Georgia Republican, was saying about how the Senate was a jury.
We urge you, the distinguished jurors in this case, not to be fooled.
This is how Bob Barr was describing the senators as members of a jury. And Harkin stands up, and this is, again, in the middle of the opening presentation.
Mr. Chief Justice, I object.
And I says, I object to that use of calling us a jury. We're actually a court.
To the use and the continued use of the word jurors when referring to the Senate sitting as triers in a trial on the impeachment of the President of the United States.
And asked Rehnquist to rule on that. And Rehnquist, in a snap decision, agrees with Harkin and says, yes, this is a court.
The chair is of the view that the senator from Iowa's objection is well taken, that the Senate is not simply a jury, it is a court in this case. And therefore, counsel should refrain from referring to senators as jurors.
It's actually not you're not a jury. This is a small distinction, but it has actually carried on. You see in legal briefs even to this day in a lot of the swirling oversight cases that I'm covering, they bring up that decision that William Rehnquist, you know, made
in a split second.
And interestingly enough, he overruled the parliamentarian who was sitting right below him who told Rehnquist, you shouldn't touch this question and you know, you should just kind of dismiss what Mr. Harkin is raising. But instead, Rehnquist, you know, in a moment's notice made that decision, which apparently really upset Trent Lott at the time, the Senate Majority Leader, because he thought that it kind of disturbed the continuity of the entire process. He was really upset, but he didn't yell at Rehnquist. He actually yelled at Alan Fruman, who was the assistant parliamentarian who was sitting right in front of him, who had been overruled. I talked to Alan Fruman about this just the other day, and he sort of recalled this like moment where Rehnquist, you know, when the gavel came down at 6 or 7 p.m., Rehnquist was out of the chamber, went back to the Supreme Court, and Fruman was left there to kind of take the heat on that. So, you know, there will be these moments where senators can step up and try and, you know, raise a point of order or try and get into things. So, you know, but here in the context of questions, yes, they'll be handing questions to the pages who then Chief Justice Roberts will read and you know, it could disturb the flow of things, but it'll be interesting to see what kinds of questions people have.
And then after the questions, we really get into, you know, we talked about things getting a little less scripted at that point. At this point, we really get into what, in my mind, I'm thinking of as the choose your own adventure portion of the trial. You know, the senators, after they finish questioning the lawyers, they will have the option to file trial motions, everything from motions to dismiss the case to motions to subpoena witnesses. And that's where things could get really interesting.
Yeah, everyone's been kind of focused so much on this process, which I think, you know, geez, it's probably not going to happen until the early part of February, right around the time of maybe last week of January. By the time we get through everything we just talked about, we're kind of at the end of January, maybe early February. So we're starting to conflict with the Iowa caucuses and the State of the Union address. But yeah, that's the point where there could be votes to dismiss, which it doesn't sound like there are votes to dismiss. And there was a vote on the motion to dismiss back in the Clinton case. There were votes on the motions for witnesses. Ultimately, they ended up with three witnesses in the Clinton case, and they were actually deposed in a closed door setting. Monica Lewinsky, Sid Blumenthal, and Vernon Jordan were the three witnesses that they deposed then. And I think the Republicans back then felt like they were kind of snookered into kind of accepting this. The House Republicans were. They felt like Trent Lott kind of tanked the trial by sort of just going with these three.
By letting them go closed door?
And narrowing it to just the three. The House Republicans, if they had their druthers, would have liked Monica Lewinsky on the floor, you know, answering these questions. Mm-hmm. The Senate Republicans were like, we don't want, you know, discussions of salaciousness and Oval Office, you know, shenanigans. And so yeah, that'll be a big question here, because here in this context, we're talking about, are we going to see Rudy Giuliani as a witness on the floor? Are we going to see Lev Parnas as a witness, John Bolton? There are a lot of names of people that, you know, I'm sure the House Democrats would like to depose in public. That will be a question. Is it in public? Would they be taking them behind closed doors and doing, you know, interviews with lawyers and then sharing the transcripts and the video for the senators to watch? Or would that happen right there live on national TV? Or would it happen on the Senate floor, but they can close the doors and
right.
go closed door? So these are all decisions that, you know, will be made in that period of time. And again, the Republicans, you have Rand Paul now threatening if the Democrats insist on the witnesses I just described, then Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, you know, who knows, would be fair game. And then, you know, this thing could really go off the rails and well, yeah, the most distinguished body in the world might end up, you know, dealing with some of the same shenanigans of the Clinton era, but in a slightly different context.
Yep. Sounds like it. And again, you know, I've got my notes here. It, obviously, if they don't do any of this, this part of the trial could take 0 days. Mm-hmm. It could take 7 days. You know, who knows? Who knows? Like I said, choose your own adventure. So after all that's done, we're going to get closing arguments. That kind of speaks for itself. That's going to last about a day. Mm-hmm. And then here's how the trial ends. After the closing arguments, we're going to go into deliberations. The Senate is going to, or at least in the last time, the Senate went behind closed doors and they deliberated for 3 days, and each senator was allowed to speak.
Yeah, each senator was allowed to speak. They later agreed to let senators put their record remarks into the public record. And so if you look back at the Clinton congressional record, you would see those remarks in sort of an exhaustive way. So to be determined if they do deliberate behind closed doors, do they even need to deliberate? You know, is this ready to just kind of wrap it up and move on? I'm sure Trump will be saying, you know, let's go, time to go. And I think that will be a big question. You know, everyone will be watching to see what Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Lamar Alexander, Ben Sasse, you know, are any of these Republicans really convinced by what they just heard? And are they going to try and bring their colleagues along to vote to convict? And, you know, the idea of 20 Republicans actually jumping ship and removing President Trump seems completely far-fetched in this moment in time. Here we are sitting, you know, the middle of January. But let's see. I mean, I would have a hard time believing it. But, you know, if Lev Parnas's interview with Rachel Maddow and then with Anderson Cooper, you know, continue to drip, drip, drip out and we learn more things and, you know, just who knows how the president's going to respond. And again, if like there's just so many intangibles that we just don't know, but
This is one of those days where I feel a little trepidatious about putting airplane mode on my phone as we walk into the podcast room. It's just like, oh my gosh, what's going to have happened by the time we get out of here?
I know. And I mean, remember during the impeachment of Bill Clinton, you know, some crazy stuff did happen. You know, the Speaker of the House stepped down because his affair was outed by Larry Flint, the Hustler publisher. And, you know, we had a major change in House Republican leadership in the midst of President's impeachment on the House floor. Yeah, this is going to be a fascinating culmination of what has been an amazing 3-year ride already.
Yeah, and Darren, we're really looking forward to having you with us the whole way to help us sort out what's going here. I love your command of the history of this stuff. It's so useful. Thank you so much for taking the time to come in and take us through it.
A couple of years of intense reading of all things impeachment. I can tout a lot of different books, but yeah, thank you for having me.
And as always, a big thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Hey, if you like this conversation with Darren, if you're interested in what on earth is going to be happening with this impeachment trial, as that sucks up our attention over the next few weeks, we are going to be doing daily coverage of the impeachment trial here on the Nerdcast. Special extra episodes. We're going to keep them short, hopefully about 5 or 7 minutes every day, trying to dig into the news of the day, some of this interesting history that Darren and others here at Politico know all about. So look out for it in your Nerdcast feed every day of the impeachment trial as that starts next week. All right, our producer this week was Annie Reese. Our senior producer is Jenny Ahmed. And our executive producer is Irene Noguchi. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you're listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, please do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the Nerdcast. Once again, thank you so much for tuning in. We'll talk again next week.